This episode contains references to suicidal ideation and sexual abuse. Listener discretion is advised.
From the outside, my life looked amazing. It was 2016. My husband at the time was French and had an accent and was very hot, and people were just like, oh, what a lovely couple. And like, I had a job that was objectively pretty fancy. I wrote cover stories and, you know, interviewed famous people and went on very complicated, expensive, elaborate, like harder assignments. What was going on in my life was that it looked exactly like a thing that I had been sold would be great for anybody or for me.
I'm speaking to Gabriel Mack. I first met Gabriel in the early days of the pandemic. I'd commissioned an essay from him for a series for The Guardian on the state of men and masculinity. He wrote about how his membership at an Equinox gym helped to save his trans soul, as he put it. Back in 2016, before he transitioned, Gabriel was an award-winning human rights journalist living an enviable life. Important job, tasteful home, handsome husband.
We had met when I was on assignment in Haiti. He was in the French military and had been lent to the United Nations peacekeeping force that was supposedly helping. That's a matter of debate, in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake.
Gabriel was there covering the chaos that persisted after the earthquake. 1.5 million Haitians had been left homeless. And making things worse, gangs and sexual violence plagued the new tent cities. It was an arduous assignment. In many ways, it was typical for the scope of his career. But in his memoir on PTSD, Irritable Hearts, he wrote about how it unmoored him. Meeting his future husband was a bright spot in an otherwise difficult time.
We met at the hotel that I was staying at, and there was like this sprawling outdoor balcony restaurant. We just like made eye contact across this restaurant, and there was something about, like, both of us were like, this seems crazy. And we just had this connection that it felt really important to not let each other go.
He spoke little English. Gabriel knew just a handful of French. Their relationship blossomed over Google Translate. And not long after, they married and settled, first in the Bay Area and later in Asheville, North Carolina. They seemed like the model of young achievement. In a photo accompanying a newspaper op-ed, Gabriel is lying on a couch, bare feet draped over his husband's lap, in a spare living room with wood floors and an arched entryway. It's a portrait of satisfaction, a desirable life.
I mean, people took pictures of us and put them in newspapers. You know, like, you definitely could have taken pictures of us and put them on a card.
Could we just dwell for a moment on how you inhabited your gender at the time?
Sure. I'm 5'9". At the time, I probably weighed 120 pounds. I was like tall and slim, extremely not athletic, but a little bit of like a slight, like a soft athletic kind of build. And I had like long hair and green eyes and just looked like a slim, conventionally very approved white gal. And so I was sort of this, everybody agreed that my gender was good. And that was like, just gonna have to be enough.
But this postcard version of success existed in parallel with a growing sense of inner unease. And the rift was starting to take a toll.
I had a lot of very intense reporting assignments. There was one in particular where I was just covering like nonstop sexual violence related things. And it had like cracked something open for me that I could not put back together. And ever since, no matter how much therapy I did or personal work I did or yoga I went to or vegetables I ate or whatever it was, like I just could not feel well.
This sense that something was off was concentrated into one persistent complaint.
It felt like there was something weird going on with my vagina.
Gabriel made the rounds of going to the doctor, trying to treat a condition that conventional medicine could neither grasp nor describe. Eventually, he wound up seeing a naturopath.
And I was like, what can you do about this? And she did all the, you know, the depositories and supplements and vitamins and all this stuff. And then finally she was like, I think your vagina is depressed.
I know. This sounds like a very West Coast diagnosis. But I've written a book on the quiet epidemic of sexual malaise, and I'd wager this condition is pretty widespread. But Gabriel was resistant to it at first.
At the time, that was too, like, Bay Area even for me, even though I went to yoga, like, constantly. So she said that I should consider psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. And I didn't go.
Gabriel was pouring his energy into maintaining the ideal life he had created. He didn't want to give it up. But slowly, out of view, it was pushing him to despondency. He was coping until he was brought to the brink.
I was in Big Sur. I was driving on the one on like one of the parts that does not have a guardrail. In my Prius, my husband at the time was running the Big Sur Marathon. And I started to like drive off the side of the cliff. And then I like yanked my car over across the lane and into like a pullout on like the cliff side instead of the water side.
Gabriel hadn't realized how desperate he was until this moment when he almost steers himself over a cliff. He was shaken to realize that the cracks and fissures inside had left him feeling suicidal.
And so at that moment in Big Sur, I was like, I have to do something.
I'm Catherine Rowland, and this is Seeking. This season, we've been exploring the healing potential of psychedelics, how they can bring ease to the mind and comfort to our bodies. And at the heart of our conversations, we've touched on the nature of healing itself. What does it mean to feel better? To no longer be embattled with our psyches or the outer world? Popular culture often pushes radical acceptance. There's a near devotion in America to the idea that if we can just reconcile ourselves to our circumstances, we'll release our anxieties and find inner peace. That's not the angle we're taking here. In today's episode, healing necessitates transformation. I've spent the better part of the past year talking to people who have taken psychedelics in one form or another. And one of the most frequent sentiments I've heard is that they're looking to effect some major change. They were hurting or stuck or swimming in uncertainty, and they wanted to submit all of that to the light. The guiding idea being that psychedelics can illuminate essential truths. Truths that feel like they're coming straight from God or the universe or your soul. And once these have been impressed upon you from whatever source of mystical authority, you're compelled to take heed. And this is why psychedelic circles are filled with revelation, but also why they're brimming with stories of upheaval. I saw the light and I left my partner, quit my job, burned my businesses to the ground. And Gabriel sensed this when he decided to take the naturopath's advice and seek out psychedelic-assisted therapy. He didn't want to court this level of disruption. To the outside eye, everything appeared great. So just make the damn shoe fit.
What I hoped was going to happen is that I would go in and then the therapy would make me feel totally okay with everything in my life exactly as it was and I wouldn't have to change anything.
So Gabriel winds up in a sweet little cottage in the North Bay for a psychedelic-assisted therapy session using MDMA. And it was lovely. But after his husband picked him up and they headed to a nearby hotel, this insistent voice threatens to upend everything.
Just like all of my insides were like, get divorced, you're gay. And I was like, oh, no. Like, first of all, I don't want to get divorced at all. I'd already been divorced once, and, like, I didn't want to get divorced again. And also that just, like, to me signified just that so much was going to change and wasn't working.
And then that voice saying, you're gay. Had you ever heard that voice before?
I'm like still like, mad at it. Even as you say, I'm just like, and that was so long ago now. And I walk around like very gay, you know, to anybody who lays eyes on me. So like, but I'm still like, oh, like I was so hell bent on not having to be this. I had not ever heard that. I'd not ever heard that voice before.
Gabriel tore out of the hotel and spent hours driving around in the dark, confused, distraught. To accept this insight as true would require dismantling the life he had worked so hard to build.
And I really wanted to maintain that. Like, I wanted to keep believing that and did not want to upset any of that status quo that I had worked out for myself.
You go off, you're driving around the North Bay. And then what happened?
I stopped and parked my car like on this cliff. Always with me in the cliffs in that Prius at the time. But I parked and I was just like, I got out of the car and I was like standing in the dark and I was like breathing and the air there just like smells like magic. You know, there's eucalyptus in it and the sea is nearby, so it's a little bit salty. And I could not imagine how I was gonna face any of the things that were trying to break into my awareness. Like, I could have, this is so dramatic, but like I could have jumped off that cliff. But I didn't, and I think what ended up happening was actually the things that I had to do were even harder, had turned out to be even harder than I was able to imagine or fathom.
Gabriel breathed in the night air and turned away from the cliff's edge. He got back in his car and returned to the hotel where his husband was waiting.
I got in bed with my husband, who was like, where the fuck were you? And I didn't sleep at all. I was just like lying there next to him, just with my eyeballs like wide open and just being like, what the fuck am I gonna do? Just like hot and like sweating and panicking. And I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop the process. It's like another door had been like kicked open just enough. And all I had been doing my entire life was standing on one side of that door, like holding it shut with every ounce of energy in my entire being, right? And it was like, I had like let go of the handle for a second and there was nothing I could do to just make the things that I was doing continue to work. I mean, they obviously already weren't. The reason I had gone to that session was literally to avert a near suicide, right? But just even to grapple with a fraction of the things that we're gonna have to change was just too much.
For months after that first trip, everything was thrown in doubt. His marriage, his career, nothing seemed to fit anymore, but he didn't know what to do. And then suddenly, an answer comes in the form of a reporting assignment.
I actually got an assignment from Rolling Stone. My editor at the time was like obsessed with ayahuasca. He didn't do ayahuasca. He was just obsessed with other people doing ayahuasca. And this was in 2016, which is not to say that there were no stories about psychedelics out, but they had not done one about like the current, you know, sort of renaissance. And so they assigned me a story about it. And in the course of doing that, I met some people who introduced me to a person who served ayahuasca, and I decided to go to a ceremony, to a couple of ceremonies.
We'll hear what happens after the break. Gabriel entered the ceremony from a place of freaking out. His inner life and his daily realities were slipping out of alignment. He was working and he was unraveling, and that was about it. Sometimes he'd catch himself standing in his apartment and looking down at his body with the sense that something was deeply amiss. So he decides to address this in the ceremony, It was in the Bay Area, led by a Californian. And Gabriel goes in with a desire to tune into his body.
That first ayahuasca session, my intention was to become embodied. I just felt like I didn't really live in my body. And so that was my intention. They served me the medicine. I had this intention. I want to be embodied. I laid down. They are singing and doing the things. And as it started to come on, I had like a few seconds of kind of like visuals, kind of like shooting stars. And then just this loud, "You are embodied, you asshole." And I was like, what? Like, I got so upset. And you'll notice this is a theme. Like, my doing psychedelics was, the brand of it was like, go do medicine and get really upset. Basically every time. Because I didn't want to know or hear any of the things that it had to say.
Within minutes, Gabriel was presented with an image that gave shape to his discomfort. Here was a window into what his body was holding inside.
It showed me this vision of myself as like a 5-year-old. I was wearing this bathing suit that I very much had. I found pictures of it afterward of me wearing it. It had like little strawberries on it or hearts with polka dots or something like that on a blue background. And I was just like was starting to walk like through a yard in this vision, but I had this immediate sense that it was going to be sex abuse related wherever this vision was going. And I was like, hard pass. And I spent the whole night resisting it and trying to shut it down. I just laid there and suffered like the most I felt like I had ever suffered in my adult life for like 5 hours.
How did you summon the bravery to continue to return to these ceremonies, knowing that that was lurking there?
The way I had started my whole psychedelics journey clearly speaks to how much my life was already not working, right? Because it was very, very explicitly suicide driven. So, like, I knew that didn't work. But so I didn't know what else to do, honestly. Like, I felt like I had to get through whatever was happening, and I couldn't just ignore it anymore. And so, I mean, I kept going. It's very sweet of you to call it brave. But honestly, I couldn't, like, I didn't feel like I had any other option.
And when in your medicine journey do you feel like you started stepping through?
What does through mean for you in that question?
When did you maybe start accompanying that child in the bathing suit?
Actually, pretty early on, the second night, I spent the entire time trying to talk to that kid who was very mad at me for lots of neglect.
Gabriel had a lot to digest after that first round of ayahuasca. But within 2 months, he returned for another weekend of ceremonies. And this time, he's confronted with an appalling vision.
It was one picture of a penis. And I was like, whose dick? That's how the ceremony started. And I was like, whose dick is this? I knew it was one that I had seen, but not one of any of my partners or anything like that. And I was like, God, please don't let this be going where I think it's going. That was it. It was just like, here's this penis. If you can accept that you recognize it and who it belongs to, then basically your entire life is going to fall apart. And it did.
I'm so curious around how you find, how anyone, I suppose, finds the ability to trust in the reality of the horror that you're presented with, you know?
Yeah. Well, the culture doesn't help, right? I mean, the whole culture has been very smartly organized re-child sex abuse around the idea that it's insane and it never happens. And people who think that it happens are crazy. And so I had imbibed as much of that narrative as anyone. It's so stupid and maddening. So anyway, having been brainwashed, like everybody, I sat up in that ceremony to sort of stop or mitigate the experience that I was having. And the person who served the medicine to me could feel and see that something was happening and came over and sat down next to me and was like, what's going on? And I said something, I don't remember exactly, but something like, I'm having some recollection of sex abuse, and I don't want to process this if it's not real. And she said, what is your body telling you? And then I cried for the next 7 hours, and then for the next 5 years, basically.
Gabriel waved aside my comment about his bravery. For him, he says it was about survival. But I still think he deserves more credit than he perhaps gives himself, because he was offered this tiny porthole into his own past, and he ended up going through it and reckoning with a history he had not allowed himself to remember. I'm just stunned by the power of it, what you can make out of a single vision, just a shaft of light in the dark.
I had the barest level of information at that time, and I got myself into therapy, and I was very lucky that I had the money to do this, because otherwise, what would I have done? All my processing of what I remembered details, aside from literally this one erection, I did sober. I did sober on my own because they just like broke in the form of flashbacks. And so once that had started happening, like I couldn't stop a lot of other details that were coming through that didn't align with this story that I had, that it had only happened one time. So I was like, okay, fine. So that means maybe it was two times, or that means maybe three times something happened, and was just sort of very gradually. It was like I was very, very, very slowly, you know, walking into the very, very cold ocean or something, and like acclimating myself a millimeter at a time as I was seeking as much support and treatment as money could buy.
Before we continue, sure. One, I just want to reflect that it is just so astounding to me that on the basis of this one vision, you were able to trust in yourself and what you needed sufficiently to seek out expert help. That kind of survival instinct kicking in, or an honoring of what you really know, is remarkable to hear. But where that takes me is you're wading out into the icy waters, acclimating, you know, one bit at a time. How are you surviving reality at that point in time? How are you continuing to exist while this whole history is coming into focus?
There was a point at which I could not actually, my move of just keeping busy, you know, just like overworking myself, was starting to fail. Like, I mean, work addiction is like any other addiction. You can only push it so far. Like, it works until it doesn't, right? It works until it kills you, or you need so much of it that like you can't even, there's not even an amount that you can get anymore that will do the thing that it did. So I started taking fewer work assignments. And again, I was lucky to have some savings to be able to do that, because I was like a crazy overworker before. And I had thought that I was saving to buy a house for like me and my husband, and we were going to have real estate, and we were going to look like a straight white couple, and everything was going to be cool, and everyone was going to like us, and that's how I was going to die, and everything would be totally fine. And I used all of that money, ultimately all of that money, on treatment for just trying to stay alive. Within 6 months of that very first MDMA session, we separated, and we were legally fully divorced less than a year later.
Within 6 months of that first MDMA session, Gabriel's life was completely transformed. He had gone from nonstop careering and success and partnership to living alone in Ashland, Oregon. Recovery became his full-time occupation, and he spent his days walking to therapy, journaling, cooking soups,
and then watching heroic doses of Netflix.
It was all he was able to manage as he tried to come to terms with what had happened to him. And he decided that part of that healing process would mean confronting the men who had abused him as a child.
If I could have gotten away with not have dealing with any of it, like, for the rest of my life, like, you know, I probably would have taken that option. But containment works until it doesn't.
More after the break.
You know, predators can feel and smell people who are outside of something in some way. They just know, even if they don't know that, you know, it's that you're trans, like something is different or something is off. In my case, I did identify myself as a boy to my primary perpetrator at some point and was immediately raped and told that that was related to why I was being raped. That wasn't the first time I had been assaulted by that person, but that story still really stuck with me, and those things were so tangled together.
In 2017, Gabriel arranged to meet this perpetrator in a public place. The man arrived and tried to hug him, and Gabriel rejected his embrace. He'd prepared no speeches and had no plan, apart from sitting on a park bench and looking this man in the eyes to tell him that he remembered a decade of sexual abuse. Gabriel says this man, his primary abuser, as he calls him, trafficked him to other men. And on this trip, he took on the hero's work of confronting both his primary abuser and another man.
I looked two of them in the face and was like, I remember what you did. They both denied it. And I flew home. And within weeks, literally weeks, like once I had done that, within weeks, I was like, oh, I'm trans.
Transitioning and going through this process of expressing yourself and liberating yourself, but also re-identifying in the world. I know you've spoken publicly about some of that process, but how did you carry through that?
You know, I did a thing before I started transitioning, and I know some other people who've done this too. I really doubled down or tripled down or quadrupled down on, like, if I lean hard enough into ladiness or whatever one has agreed that is, like, that's gonna work it out. So I bought, like, all of these dresses and I started wearing them. And I would go out into the world and people, I would just, like, I'd be walking through a bar or a restaurant, whatever, and total strangers would just, like, walk up to me and be like, oh, my God, you look amazing in this. And I was just, like, getting, like, all the feedback from the whole world was, like, keep doing what you're doing.
But it didn't work.
Transitioning didn't feel like a choice. It didn't feel like a choice when the only other choice was to die. Not only could my soul not be alive if I didn't transition, like, I could not be alive, like, in this body, in human form, if I didn't transition. You know, the world makes it as hard as it reasonably can. And so I just became, like, a medical transition logistics, like, expert.
Gabriel spent months making insurance appeals, going to therapists and doctors, and writing letters as part of the process of getting coverage to medically transition.
It took a lot of time off work, partly because I didn't have the bandwidth to do work, but also because I didn't know what work was gonna look like.
He had to reassess what felt safe to take on as an assignment.
Like, mid-transition, could I have gotten on a plane and, like, been reporting in Syrian refugee camps, talking to these, like, high-level Turkish officials who couldn't figure out what my gender was the whole time and me, like, trying to insist on pronouns to them or something? I mean, it's not to say that I could not have done that, but I certainly would not have felt safe doing it, and it would have made my job about 400 billion times more complicated than it already was.
But a bigger question was, what did he now want to say?
As I became more able, like, I started to have more energy because I was getting further along in recovery and just the whole process. Some of the places where I used to work were reaching out, and some were reaching out just to offer me assignments, and some were reaching out to ask me to do like their token trans thing. And it was sort of this like, what do I want to, do I care about this? As it turns out, what I want to talk about the most is the thing that I was not allowed to talk about for my whole childhood.
Gabriel had a story to tell, one that he has spent years trying to recover and make sense of. But it's the kind of story that the public routinely censors and that publishers shy away from. Gabriel didn't want to strip his story of the truth as he knows it, so he walked away from the book deals and the bylines and the world of mainstream publishing.
Having people tell me that I couldn't say what was true about the sex abuse and being censored all the time. And like, to me, that's a thing that is really, 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 really missing from just representation in the culture. Like, every sex abuse survivor who I've ever met feels just like heart-shatteringly, like mind-blowingly alone and isolated, even though it is not in remotely isolated. I mean, we're everywhere. Feels like a huge open secret, but it gives everyone plausible deniability to never let anybody write about it.
Gabriel and I are speaking over Zoom. Right now, he's living in a spacious RV parked on a sheep farm in Washington State. He's been here for a few months, but is preparing to set out tomorrow. The rain is pinging away on the metal roof, and when we began talking, I could hear a space heater humming away in the background. It would be glib to say he's come a long distance from the cute homes and the picture-ready life, but this has all been by choice, a bid for freedom, and there's an enviable quality to these days as well.
When you look back on what psychedelics do, how would you say they've changed your relationship to things like trust and faith and reality?
I feel like psychedelics ended up being just a giant trust fall, like the world's largest, most epic, complicated trust fall. It takes an extra kind and I think amount of energy to build a life that doesn't suit you at all. I can feel in this conversation, and I'm surprised to learn that there's still part of me that's like upset that I had to give it up. Like I was so sold on it. I really believed that if I just did it correctly or long enough or right enough or perfectly enough, I could force it to work for me. But finding your way to trust after you've been taught and scolded and like, you know, violently molded to not trust yourself is really hard, is really, really hard. And I don't think anybody could argue, people who hate trans people, you know, would definitely be like, he ruined his life. You know, like, should have kept the boobs and the hot French husband, obviously. But nobody could argue that I didn't reclaim trust with myself. And I'm struggling to think of a thing that's more valuable than that.
Gabriel hasn't done psychedelics in more than a year. As he speaks, I find myself nodding. This is integration. Transmuting trauma and becoming the person you know yourself to truly be.
What do you feel comes next for you?
And this is exactly what I was trying to avoid that first night after my very first MDMA session, right? It was like, I need to have a plan. It needs to be very specific and hopefully as heteronormative as I can possibly make it look to the outside and like fit into as many boxes as I can that everyone has agreed are okay. And this is like the full blown, the most full blown opposite of that. Like, I'm gay, I'm trans, I'm asexual, I live in an RV the day after tomorrow. I don't know where I'm gonna sleep, but I found my way to the place I'm in now. And I know that I'm gonna know what to do when I get there and like when it's happening. And I just have trust.
Gabriel didn't want to uncouple from society's version of the happy life, but forces inside compelled him. He couldn't keep the truth sequestered away. Not knowing where he was going to sleep, He was heading to a festival and then on to the next chapter.
It's so different than anything that I had ever thought it was allowed to look like. And it really involved embracing everything, like, in this process. I've always been clinging to, like, some vestige of some normie, totally arbitrary, frankly, you know, rule about what things are supposed to be like and what people are supposed to be like. And it, like, every single one of them turned out to be not me. And yeah, and I've had to embrace everything that I was afraid of. And it turned out to be totally fine. I mean, better than fine.
When I set out to report for this season, I knew that I was going to be exploring something mystical, profound. It's with good reason that people often rank their psychedelic journeys as among life's most meaningful experiences. They tend to be up there with giving birth and witnessing death and meeting your beloved. They were for me. But I didn't quite appreciate until I was close to wrapping this all up that the project had become a sort of prayer. Not quite Don Enrique's prayer that the plant spirits or God will travel through my voice and reach your heart and convince you to walk the medicine path. No, it's a prayer that began to take shape as I spoke with Dre from the Ancestor Project and with the veterans. And I think it crystallized with Gabriel. And that's our capacity for making good on our revelations. The world isn't just a plunge into chaos. There are truths to behold and to be transformed by. And even if psychedelics provide just a glimpse into that, it's a glimpse that can break the dam.
The thing is, my tide of revelations is part of my, it's just part of my life now. I took my fortress down and now I can just, like, the truth, it just flows freely through my life and through my existence.
In our next season, we'll be moving away from questions of healing and looking instead at what it means to be human.
Every single human I would walk past would look at me really weird, and I first thought they were, you know, angry or scared or hated me or whatever. But now I know the real truth, they're jealous. They're jealous of me being a robot because it's a new form of life and they know that.
And we're starting with death and the quest for immortality. We'll be stepping into an entirely new world to meet the transhumanist pioneers who believe they can use science and technology to overcome our biological limits.
We self-experiment with medications. I take lots and lots of medications that have anti-aging properties, lots and lots of dietary supplements that may have disease-preventing properties, and, well, hormones, whatever else I need.
These seemingly wild ideas tap into a universal feeling, a fear of the end. Seeking is written and reported by me, Catherine Rowland. This episode was produced by Erica Gajda and edited by Megan Dietry. Megan Dietry is our series editor and executive producer. Fact-checking by Natsumi Ajisaka. Sound design by Tiffany Walker and Rob Dozier. Music by Nolan Schneider. Mixing by Sam Baer. Thanks to our legal team, Rachel Goldberg and Allison Sherry. And special thanks to Lizzie Jacobs.